Good afternoon, everyone. I'll reconvene the hearing in 4 subdivision. We have Commissioner Stevens on my left and Commissioner Robinson for this stream. Now, Ms. Scott, before you start, your reply on the heritage section raised a question for me that I think it's important to raise now. In your reply, you dealt with the issue of what will be in stage 2 of the district plan and attached an appendix. The appendix is very good as the process, but doesn't actually tell us what will be in stage 2 and what will remain operative. And from the panel's point of view, we need to know, certainly before the end of this spring, which bits of the operative plan will not be reviewed, because the subdivision section interfaces with a number of sections which I suspect fall into that category. And the earthworks chapter being one of them. There is also a question as to whether other chapters, such as Remarkables Park, have to interface with this that's been raised in submissions. And if it doesn't, then do we have 2 subdivision chapters operative at the same time? And where does that leave everyone? I think these are quite important issues that need to be addressed by the council. And I realise you don't have that information to hand at the moment, but I think by the time we get to the end of this stream, we do need to know that. The other thing that I will alert you to, that you can pass on to the council, so I've tried to find the operative chapter 22 on the council website, and couldn't, which is rather unhelpful.
Yes, good afternoon, Mr. Chair. In terms of the latter, I had the same issue. I had to have a copy of it. We can provide that for you if you haven't already been provided it.
I did last year, or earlier this year, or late last year, get a copy of it, a copy of what was attached to the council agenda, and I presume that is the same, but it's different. It would be helpful to have the operative version.
For my benefit, Mr. Chairman, can you tell me what chapter 22 is about?
Earthworks. Yes.
So chapter 22 is the earthworks chapter, which is in the operative plan, and the earthworks chapter is excluded from that review. In terms of your earlier query about a table or further information about what is to be included in stage 2 and will be excluded. There was a table included in our opening submission for the strategic direction hearing.
Is that the table you attached in appendix 1?
No, it's not. So it's page 8 of our opening submission for the first hearing, strategic direction hearing, and that table has what's been notified in stage 1 and the council's position on what was to be notified in stage 2 at the time of filing those legal submissions.
My recollection is that it is indeed there in the body of your legal submissions. The follow-up question I had was that Mr. Young, notwithstanding that, Mr. Young seems to be under the impression that the Remarkables Park Zone will not be the subject of stage 2, and perhaps it would be good if you could confirm whether or not that is or not the case before he arrives. And if you're telling me, well, one way or another, that may mean he doesn't arrive at all.
Yes. Well, the subdivision chapter, as notified, includes a statement to the effect that the following zones are not part of the proposed district plan, and the subdivision chapter shall not apply to them. So that statement, in effect, means that subdivision chapter that's been notified and we're dealing with in this hearing as a whole doesn't apply to those stage two zones. As we outlined in our opening and closing, I recall the strategic directions hearing, the other district-wide chapters that have been notified in stage one are not drafted in that way, in that they are drafted as district-wide chapters. But the subdivision chapter has taken a different approach where it doesn't just say that, for example, the minimum lot sizes for stage two zones are to be notified in stage two. It actually states that the entire subdivision chapter doesn't apply to them. What that means is that in stage two, not only will minimum lot sizes need to be notified for the stage two zones, the council's going to need to look at notifying the chapter again. And no decisions have been made on that, but that is the effect of those words that were included in the notified chapter.
Mm. Mr. Price has recommended deletion of all those words.
He is. And there has been some submissions filed about the deletion of those words. They are, I think, they were deleted because of, I think the reason is here, they were provided to us as same users in terms of identifying scope, in terms of the regulatory effect of the chapter moving forward. But he has reconsidered that recommendation in light of the submissions that had been filed, and I understand he's happy to bring that back in, but with some amended wording, which is set out in my opening, which we will get to, I think it's right at the back.
Mm, yes. Would it be more valuable, given the whole raft of different things happening because of the plan being done in stages, if rather than putting pieces in each individual chapter saying this doesn't apply or that does, to actually have something up the front in the plan that the council could prepare that would show which bits of the proposed plan would apply and which bits of the operative plan will remain, because from my recollection of what you described from the initial hearing, it told us what would be in stage two, but I'm not sure that we can see any detail about what remained operative and how that interfaced, and how that interface would occur. Earthworks is a good example because that interfaces quite clearly with subdivision, and it has a chapter number which is the same as the rural living chapters in the proposed plan, so that has to change, and it wasn't created to give effect to the policies, objectives and policies in the strategic direction chapters, so we don't know to what extent that interfaces well with what we're dealing with now.
Yes, we have responded to the suggestion in earlier submissions, and council submission is it doesn't want to put that type of explanation in the plan, because when it becomes operative, or when we get through the process,
that
will change and it will need to come out. And what we covered in, I can't recall if it was our opening or closing for that first hearing, but is potentially better education and better communication with the public and, of course, with the hearing panel. And as you foreshadowed when you asked me this question, I'm not in a position to provide that information right now. Stage two is work in progress, and of course the council.
I understand that. It's not the stage two that is so critical, it's the bits that won't be in stage two.
Yes.
Because stage two, of course, can catch up, if you like,
yes,
with these provisions. It's the bits that won't change that are probably we need to, because of obviously just looking at the earthworks chapter, there might be things we need to recommend, need to change there to mesh with the subdivision chapter, which we can do as a suggestion as to variation, and there may be things in other chapters which need that sort of provision.
Yes, absolutely, and as I foreshadowed in the closing for historic heritage and protected trees, there are some options in terms of how the chapters are going to come together, and through the section 42A assessment of the submissions, that has brought the council closer to actually getting it to its final position after it's considered the submissions. And as you will see and hear, there has been quite some movement, particularly in this chapter, in response to submissions, which really has had to take place before the council is in any position to understand what needs to happen. There is certainly the option of the variation if that's required, and there's obviously support for 16A and 20A as well after the plan becomes operative. But the council's aware that one of those three approaches will likely be needed at that stage.
Okay, thank you. Now, that we've had that discussion, we can turn to
subdivision.
Yes.
Thank you. So, I've handed out a case book in terms of some cases that were referred to in the council's opening. On the 19th of July, we filed the same section 42A report but with updated references as requested by the panel. So, I'll be referring to that version of the section 42A and also the revised proposal, just because with the additional text, the page numbers have changed slightly, so I understand that the price is going to be the same, so that we've all got the right reports in front of us. So these written legal submissions, they explain the council's approach to consideration and deferral of submission points, provide a general overview of subdivision under the RMA, address activity status for subdivision within the district, and also address some other key issues that have been raised in submissions and evidence files in relation to this chapter. In terms of the evidence that's been filed, it is fairly limited. I think there's been 11 statements, and the council's witnesses and Mr. Bryce have considered that evidence and have accepted some of the recommendations made in them. In the second half of these submissions, I have set out Mr. Bryce's position on them to assist the panel with submitted, some of those points are clearly of a planning nature, but they are set out there essentially rather than Mr. Bryce's evidence summary. Again, we refer to and adopt the opening legal submission that was filed in the strategic directions hearing in terms of the council's functions and statutory obligations, relevant legal considerations, and the matters that have scope. So would you like me to take you through the section on the submissions that have been deferred, or would you like to take that as read?
I'm happy with that, except for I'll say I noted your comment about Mr. Farrell's evidence, and I'll raise it on Mr. Farrell myself anyway.
Yes.
Section paragraph 3.5. Raises a question about what we'll be hearing on Jack's point. Presumably there was a recent private pay change that we're not dealing with, and I suspect that some of Mr. Wells' evidence related to that rather than the original Jack's Point provisions, and it seemed to me rather murky as to what we would be dealing with.
Yes. So, the plan change is subject to appeal at the moment through appeal to the Environment Court, and at the moment there's been no outcome there, that is work in progress. In terms of Mr. Wells' suggestion,
before you go on, Ms. Scott, just for my notes, what plan change number is that?
Plan change 44.
Thank you.
So at Jack's Point, there's the wider Jack's Point zone, and then Hanley Downs makes up part of the zone. And Mr. Wells' evidence suggests deferring consideration of some objective policies and rules as they relate only to the Hanley Downs part of Jack's Point. And that is the part that I am, or the council is concerned about, because the way this chapter is drafted is that the objectives and policies and parts of the rules that I understand he is referring to apply to all of the Jack's Point zone, not just to Hanley Downs. So we hold some concern that deferring them may create some complexity. Are you deferring the objectives and policies only as they apply to that part of land, or as they apply to the entire part of the land? So that's the concern, and clearly submission points do need to be allocated to hearings and not pushed around as much as possible. I've experienced that recently in another area, and I have tried to put it as much as possible here.
Yes. But is it likely, I mean, given that the Jack's Point hearing won't be until February of next year, is it likely that there'd be an outcome from the Environment Court before then?
I would hope so. Yes.
Would it be...
That's not a guaranteed outcome.
No, I hope so. Yes, I understand. Sometimes can take 3 years to write a decision. Hopefully no longer.
Hopefully not with 5%
order. Yes. I'm just wondering whether, given those circumstances, it might be more sensible to actually defer all of those provisions to that hearing, including the objects and policies specific to Jack's Point in Chapter 27. So that we can deal with that issue when we've got finality on change 44, because that's one of the ones where the interface is quite important, but it's critical in fact.
Yes, if they are deferred and they apply to all the Jack's Point, that would be sensible.
Yes. Well, we've deferred all the submissions relating to lot sizes. And in Jack's Point, there are quite a few submissions on details of the zoning, so it wouldn't seem illogical to include the objects and policies relating to subdivision there with that.
Yes, the council would be happy with that. The concern was really looking at after the five and half of the zone.
Okay. Well, I'm happy to order that if necessary. That presumably means that Mr. Wells' evidence can be deferred as well on Jack's Point.
Yes, Mr. Barr has just missed that discussion. But perhaps if I liaise with him during the adjournment and I can confirm that afterwards, but I suspect it will be.
Yeah. I mean, that may mean that we have to get Mr. Bryce back part of that hearing as well. I suspect human lot sizes might be relevant.
That will already be happening, I
understand. Yes.
So that's
fine.
Okay. So just in paragraph 3.6, some submissions from the heritage chapter, which represents this chapter, I just want to add rule 26.6.21 to the first line. Sorry, that was missing. So submissions of two notified rules.
Sorry, can you just repeat that? What is it?
26.6.21. 21. 21 or 2.1? 21. 21. Okay, so turning to section 4. To assist the panel, I have set out in this section a high-level overview of the subdivision process under the RMA. Subdivision provisions are one tool.
Sorry to interrupt you, but just before you go on, at the same hearing that we hear Jack's Point, we hear Millbrook. Is there any of the provisions, submissions on the subdivision chapter in relation to Millbrook that would also be sensible to defer at the same time? And that's something we can look at in the adjournment, perhaps.
Thank you.
Sorry.
That's okay. So back to paragraph 4.2. So the purpose of this section is really to assist the panel on some subdivision basics as such. The subdivision provisions can be included in the plan through objectives, policies and rules. And provisions may be, and they apply district-wide, but we can also have location-specific provisions, for example, Jack's Point and Millbrook. Provisions may also incorporate by reference detailed codes of subdivision and, for example, subdivision design guidelines. Subdivision provisions can also incorporate the inclusion of structure plans. These are also called concept plans or development plans. They don't appear to be used consistently within the country, that is relevant to the position that the council has reached in terms of control activity status applying to any subdivision in accordance with the structure plan that is included into the proposed plan. The subdivision is essentially the division of an allotment by a number of methods, all of which are set out in section 218 of the RMA. And no person may subdivide land unless subdivision is allowed by a rule in a district plan and a proposed district plan or a resource consent. And of course there's no current, we don't have national environment standards that allow subdivision at this stage. So the difference there is that subdivision must be allowed either as a permitted activity or you obtain consent, and that is a different approach to land use under the plan generally. So land subdivision essentially creates separate titles and restrictions on landowners or occupiers, and its successes as to how the land can be used or developed may be imposed through conditions of consent imposed under sections 108 and 220 of the RMA. That is of particular relevance because if you have a controlled activity or a restricted discretionary activity, any conditions of consent need to be related to a topic that is listed in the matter of control or matter of discretion. So if your rule is not drafted in a way that covers a matter, then you cannot then include a condition of consent on something unless it is one of the additional matters listed in section 220 of the RMA. In the case of conditions having ongoing effect, consent notices are registered on the computer register, and subdivision also provides the opportunity for a council to require land to be vested and reserve and other financial contributions to be taken to provide necessary infrastructure. In paragraph 4.5, I refer to section 6 of the RMA. Subdivision is of course relevant, and three topics I have listed there are for hearings we have already heard, but they are also of relevance to subdivision in the same way that development is of relevance. 4.6, I mentioned there that the council may include rules in its plan to provide the setting aside of esplanade reserves or esplanade strips. And finally, in paragraph 4.7, the council may refuse to grant a consent or may grant a subdivision consent subject to conditions under section 106 of the RMA if it considers land is or is likely to be subject to material damaged by erosion, falling debris, subsidence, slippage, or inundation from any source, and the council may also review the subdivision consent if sufficient provision has not been made regarding legal and physical access to the allotments within it.
Ms. Scott, before you go on from that subject, have you had the opportunity to read the submissions that Mr. Goldsmith has pre-lodged that I received about 9 o'clock this morning?
No.
Right, I'll foreshadow the argument that Mr. Goldsmith is running because I wanted to get your reaction. And if you haven't read them, this may simply be a suggestion, that a request that you think about it and give us a more formal response in reply. One of the justifications in the section 42A for a more onerous activity classification than controlled is the need to have a discretion to cover inadequate roading requirements and inadequate access. The argument that Mr. Goldsmith is going to press us with is that section 106 gives the council a complete discretion, irrespective of what the status of the subdivision is, on those matters. And I suppose that was the issue to draw to your attention and suggest that we might need your input on that point.
Yes, thank you. I haven't seen a copy of them, but I'll get a copy. Which turns out, of course, to the activity status, the subdivision, which is at the heart of Mr. Goldsmith's submission, I suspect. So we have the notified plan included essentially a default discretionary activity status, and a variety of submissions were received seeking different types of relief. Mr. Bryce's section 42A goes through the different types of relief sought in some detail. There are a number of submissions which seek an activity status that the submitter considers as appropriate for the type of subdivision and the zone that type of subdivision is within. And there are, of course, the submissions which seek that we go back to the operative chapter, which has as its default control activity status. So that essentially opens up the scope right up in terms of anywhere between discretionary and controlled. But there are, of course, and I wish to draw to the panel's attention, a lot of submissions seeking that a specific type, activity type is relevant depending on the location. And subdivision type, and whether you're in urban or a rural area, for example. So Mr. Bryce, as you will see from his recommended chapter, has moved away from the notified approach and has recommended a controlled activity status for subdivision in accordance with the structure plan that is located either in a subdivision chapter or in a zone-specific chapter. A controlled activity status for boundary adjustments, restricted discretionary for subdivision in urban and rural living areas, along with a non-notification clause for subdivisions that are classified RDA, and he has a different rule for the urban and rural RDA activity status because of some different methods of discretion. Again, RDA for boundary adjustments in Arrowtown and on any site containing a heritage or any other protected item. Discretionary activity status for subdivision within the rural zone and existing character zone. And finally, discretionary activity status for subdivision of land containing a heritage or any protected item, heritage landscape sites with known archaeological sites and EPNA, significant natural areas.
Mr. Scott, would it be better for me to ask questions of Mr. Bryce as to why he's chosen various of those, or sort of raise those with you?
I suspect that's more of a planning question, so I'm happy for you to direct them to Mr. Bryce.
Okay, thank you.
So, paragraph
And while you're, before you're about to launch into that discussion, I was going to ask you about your discussion of the particular rationale for structure plans. And is that an issue for Mr. Bryce too?
Yes, it is. I do turn to structure plans regularly in the submissions, but Mr. Bryce can answer those questions, and he has had some experience in the district in terms of processing consents that have been linked to a structure plan, and also linking processing consents that haven't been linked to a structure plan, and that's. He's also been on the developer side as well, so he has some experience in that.
Well, having interrupted you, I'll explain to you precisely what my point is, then you can tell me whether you want to defer it to him. Having read your submissions, I pulled out of the proposed plan, I turned up the Jack's Point and the Millbrook structure plans, which seem to me to be singularly skeletal documents, and in terms of the emphasis that Mr. Bryce and Mr. Faulkner have given the need for control over road layouts, Jack's Point has an indicative road layout, and as far as I could see, Millbrook doesn't have a road layout at all on the structure plan, and so the question is, when is a structure plan a structure plan? Do we in fact need a definition as to what is an acceptable structure plan? I understand completely the logic that you're putting forward that has prompted Mr. Bryce, but is it to shift ground? But do we need some controls as to, as I say, when is a structure plan for the purposes of this rule?
Thank you, Mr. Robinson. I asked Mr. Price the same question this morning.
Before you answer, can I throw in that I was going to ask you whether, in fact, a plan should have a section, an appendix to Chapter 27, which should include the structure plans to which this rule applies, so that there was a clear. So it wasn't just anything that a private plan change may say was a structure plan, but something which has been accepted as appropriate for the rules.
Yes. Ideally, for consistency's sake, they would all be located in the same chapter. I see the value in doing that. Going back to your question, Commissioner Robinson, I have been giving some thought as to whether a policy that set out what the minimum requirements for a structure plan are, the value of such a policy. On a structure plan you do have sometimes like a key structuring elements or fixed structuring elements and flexible structuring elements. The key structuring elements are, you know, the crucial ones, and often they are the access. And the RPS that we have here isn't particularly directive in terms of assisting us. In other areas we have very directive RPSs which tells us exactly what needs to be in the structure plan before it gets into the plan. We don't have that guidance here, but I think there is value in such if it's a policy, and I'm not aware of the scope of information to bring that in or not. I would have to look into that. But in terms of having a control activity rule, and the justification for it from the council perspective is that there's sufficient certainty in the plan because of the structure planning, then the structure plan needs to show the key structuring elements for that area.
Perhaps the submission seeking a shift to a controlled activity could be prayed and aid to provide jurisdiction for a policy to support that shift as a consequence.
Yes, and that would assist in the future, but we do need, there are existing structure plans, so we will have to deal with them here and there as well.
So, yes, that raises the question whether we do, because other than Jack's point in the book, chapter 12 of the operative plan doesn't apply to the proposed plan.
There's also a waterfall park.
Yes, but it doesn't have a structure plan.
I think it does, doesn't it?
I believe it does.
Oh, well, in that case, yes. But is it necessary,
and that's even more skeletal than the others,
is it necessary that council, that the proposed district plan, council proposed a policy and we accepted it and recommended a policy as to what should be within a structure plan, excluded an existing one? I can't see that that's necessarily a problem. It might just require that existing ones need to be brought up to scratch.
Through this process.
Or through the process, or follow the alternative consent process, if that's where we end up.
Yes.
That's probably the answer, isn't it?
Yes. So, Mr. Bryce will be listening, and I'm sure he will be willing to put pen to paper and think about such a policy. And that will give future guidance and direction for future structure plans coming into the plan, and that would align with the council's, it's in the section 42A, that controlled activity status is essentially a bonus and would encourage someone to bring a structure plan forward to put into the plan. So with that structure plan you move from RDA to control activity.
Well, I'm sure you'll find examples in regional policy statements around the country.
Yes, I can direct them to us. Well, I'm looking to go through the same process up there.
And the Auckland, regional policy statement, I think, has a 55-page appendix on the structure patterns.
The Canterbury RVR, yes, has one. One method to make it up, So turning back to the commission, we've spoken about a structure plan, and Mr. Faulkner's evidence supports the council's position in terms of controlled activity status linking with subdivision in accordance with the structure plan, and his evidence is that good design principles are already installed in the structure plan, therefore providing a positive response to location specific characteristics. Mr. Bryce then recommends a restricted discretionary consent, and he has taken into account the submissions which talk about the that challenge the level of certainty that is given or was given with the discretionary, fully discretionary rule that was notified. And he has carefully drafted matters of discretion to fit with that rule. As I mentioned, his rule framework responds to subdivision within rural living areas, so the rural residential and rural lifestyle zones, and urban areas. So there's a different rule for each of those. If I can turn the page to paragraph 5.9, and here we're turning to the council's concern with using a global control activity status. Part of the concern is the council's inability to decline applications that have substandard subdivision design, in particular in terms of roading and allotment layout and connection of the subdivision with the existing neighbourhood. A subdivision design is of course critical to the effective functioning of the district because the subdivision approval process encompasses the design, construction and vesting of infrastructure and services that are then inherited by the community. And just aspects of subdivision design include road layout, pedestrian and cycle connections, parks, reserves and open spaces, So there's a number of elements that are feeding into subdivision and the rules that we're looking at through this hearing. At paragraphs 5.11 and 12, this goes back to the operative district plan framework. And what Chapter 27 in the operative plan attempts to do is anticipate all possibilities of an application, and the matters of control and discretion take up some 29 pages in the operative plan. And so working through them is, I understand, a fairly lengthy and complex exercise in terms of working out which activity status you get to in terms of your application. Mr. Bryce's evidence is that only 31% of applications processed and granted under the operative district plan had a controlled activity status. 69% were either restricted, discretionary or non-compliant. So the ability to decline consent is essentially already a feature of the existing operative district plan subdivision chapter.
Ms. Scott, can I interrupt you with another gem from Mr. Goldsmith's submissions that you have read? He suggests that those figures are skewed because they will take into account all of the subdivisions in the rural general zone, which will necessarily be discretionary. You may not be in a position to answer that question, but I'll put it on the table so that Mr. Bryce can have his answer ready to go.
Thank you. So turning to controlled activity status, this section of my submission endeavours to get into controlled activity status in a little bit more detail. There are four key elements. The council must grant a resource consent, with limited exceptions, one being under section 106, as already discussed. The council's power to impose conditions is restricted only to the matters over which control is reserved. And part two matters and the broader terms of regional and district plans might help to inform the wording of those reserved areas of control. So generally they are specific and focused on a district in terms of what are the key matters for that district or that particular zone or sub-zone. The activity must also comply with the requirements, conditions and permissions for any specified in the RMA and the plan or proposed plan. So for example, in the subdivision chapter there are minimum lot sizes that you must achieve to be controlled activities. And finally, the council's ability to impose conditions on a consent for a controlled activity is subject to the legal principle that a condition on a resource consent cannot negate the consent itself. In terms of the fourth element, I have covered some case law that addresses these matters, but essentially a condition of a controlled activity consent it may modify the consent, but it may not go as far as meaning the consent is granted, but the consent is applied for. It's actually a different creature. And the best example that comes to mind is, for example, if there were concerns with the width of an access and the controlled activity rule was drafted in a way that it was a matter of control, so the council can consider it and can issue a condition on that matter. The condition may say that the width needs to be X instead of Y, and that is a change which essentially means the rest of the subdivision application cannot be provided for within the boundary or the outline of the scope as applied for. So one might say, well, we'll just pull out some allotments and there'll be less allotments in the subdivision and you can still go ahead. But a developer, when they put that subdivision together, would have been looking at the viability of that application And for the council to turn around and say, well, you can have your consent and we must grant it, but you can't have as many allotments, and he wrote a condition telling you that, that is stepping into away from just modifying the consent. And that is a matter that needs to be considered on a case-by-case basis. It's difficult to say that it's just the line and stand where it's drawn, but the case law clearly says that you cannot negate a consent in terms of what was applied for simply through a condition of consent.
Ms. Scott, can I invite you to ponder a different hypothetical? Because it seems to me that subject to the input you're going to give us on the potential ambit of 106, if Mr. Goldsmith's submission is right and 106 is broad enough because it covers access to cover road widths, I think Mr. Faulkner talks about road layout as a fundamental component of subdivision design, and you might be on stronger ground taking a stand on subdivision design and the need to shift road layout from not just the width, but if you want to have a proper road design, to have a proper subdivision design, the road literally needs to be somewhere else. All of the lots are going to be different sizes as a result. Different so you may well have the same number of lots, you may not, but you may well have the same number.
Mm.
But it seems to me that if you take your stand on subdivision design and road layout being key to that, it's hard to think how you can impose a condition, a valid condition, to achieve that. Now, that's a proposition, and as I say, I just think that you may be going down a blind alley talking about road widths, quite apart from the fact that Mr. Wallace's code of practice will have tomes on what widths roads need to be for different size subdivisions that are there.
Yes, well, road width is just one example, and even if the matters of control relate back to the subdivision design guidelines, there may be an inherent tension where the lot layout creates an inconsistency with that design guideline. And it might align with part of the subdivision design guideline, but not all of it. And not promoting good subdivision design across all of the guidelines is a concern of the council. And it's just not the matter of minimum width of roads. And of course, section 106 is focused only on legal and physical access to each allotment. And the council's concern is wider than that in terms of good subdivision design, as Commissioner Robinson has just referred to.
Is section 106 directed solely to the allotments that are within the subdivision application?
It seems to be created by the subdivisions.
So if a subdivision precluded, if a subdivision proposal precluded access to an adjacent site, which would be available, would that be another instance where the council would be seeking to a change in the design?
And that the outcome that it might want to try and get might possibly require a change, which is because we've got the boundaries of the subdivision application. The outcome, or the to sort that out, is maybe a fundamental change to the application as was applied for to start with. And section 106, the wording is sufficient provision has not been made for legal and physical access to each allotment to be created by the subdivision. So that is one particular scenario where the council can decline consent, even if it is controlled activity status, but it doesn't cover all of the concerns that the council has. Moving to, excuse me, paragraph 5.20, just a brief response there. Mr. Ferguson's evidence is that the council's justification for RDA based on the existence of landscape effective zones is flawed. And he states that the panel will need to conduct an inquiry first in the appropriateness of the spatial planning outcomes before it settles on the provisions that will apply to those areas, including subdivisions. This isn't accepted by the council. This goes back to the council's approach that it has brought through the strategic directions and rural chapters, that there is a significant amount of land within the district zone for urban development, and that land doesn't have a structure plan in place at this point in time.
From your view, is the evidence of Mr. Ferguson and the evidence of Mr. Brown directed to rural living zones or urban zones?
I understand the former, but I would need to read it again to confirm that, but I understand
it. It would be useful if you... Yes.
The wider cases that they're bringing through each hearing has had that focus to it, so...
Thank you.
And finally, at paragraph 5.21, the recommended RDA rule includes non-notification rule. So this also provides certainty that the consideration of the development details is a matter between the council and the developer. And finally, the New Zealand Fire Service supports this approach, and Heritage New Zealand also supports the council's discretionary activity status for subdivision to land containing heritage items. Under the subheading Jack's point...
Before you go on, Ms. Scott, can I just pose another question on this fundamental point of consent status? You'll recall back in March when you and your colleague, Mr. Winchester, opened the council's case. I queried the lack of quantitative analysis of costs and benefits for the purposes of section 32.2 in relation to the strategic chapters, and Mr. Winchester's response was, well, these are strategic high-level chapters, economic evidence wouldn't be any use, the economists would never agree, I'm paraphrasing now, it wouldn't be, it's not practical in the sense of it wouldn't be of any assistance. But here we're talking about consent status, which at one level is contended by the submitters that controlled status has a particular value to them, and anything less than controlled status has a significant cost to them, and they also challenge the extent of the benefits. And so my question to you is, are we in a position to form a view as to the correct status in the absence of quantitative analysis of the costs and benefits? Because I freely acknowledge that submitters haven't given us any quantitative analysis either. But I'm concerned about the position this hearing panel is in, having to form a view satisfying itself on section 32 we're in the absence of quantitative analysis. So I'll throw that curveball and invite your comment.
Yes, we did. In response to your questions back in March, we did bring economic evidence in the context of the rural hearing, which you weren't there, but you are right, we do not have economic evidence before you for this hearing, and the section 32 is very light in that respect, in that it focuses only on qualitative cost and benefits. So section 32 does use the words "where practical" and I don't want to place too much weight on them, but bringing specific numbers in terms of the cost that a controlled activity status may, a restricted discretionary activity status may include compared to a controlled activity status is essentially the council doesn't hold that the necessary information in terms of bringing evidence that would really assist the panel in its decision making. It is a difficult, or reasonably difficult question to provide economic evidence on. I know that's not a particularly straight answer, but there is qualitative section 32 evidence before you, and Mr. Bryce has endeavoured to bring that into one location in terms of updating the section 32. There's an appendix 2 or 3 to his section 42A. There is he's completed a further section 32AA, and I do draw your attention to that because it can be looked at there in the appendices. So he has completed that work, but I acknowledge that we don't have that specific quantitative analysis before you.
Is that because that's the kind of information the developers would have?
Yeah, well, they do hold that information.
Well, I might ask them that question then.
The other thing relevant to that, Scott, I'm wondering whether is there a difference in the way that we should approach that analysis, given the difference between sections 11 and 9, and that the starting point in each section is different, and whether the costs and benefits have to be related to the starting point provided by the Act. Is that a relevant consideration for us?
I'm not aware of any case law that is correct on that point, but it is there's clearly a different approach that is taken to subdivision under the RMA in that respect. So the starting point is ultimately the other end of the spectrum. So it does form, it is relevant, yes. It's a case law that says that. I'm not aware of any, but I will go away and do some research.
There isn't a lot of case law on section 32 anyway, and especially in the guy's version that we have to deal with.
Well, it's recently new.
And we haven't seen Crown actually do any such analyses on their national policy statements, so we don't have any guidance from those who wrote the legislation. So it's just a framework.
No. And I've been involved in other subdivision chapters where there wasn't much information on quantitative evidence for activity status with subdivision, and Section 32 is proving to be a problem across the country in terms of, and Section 32AA of course, because of the standard that it sets, but we haven't got anywhere in the courts in terms of what it actually means yet.
The other question too, I wonder, is the requirements put on us under section 32AA is where we recommend a change from what was notified. Is that what we should direct our attention to, or should we direct our attention to what the operative plan says? Put it this way.
Sorry, I'm not sure I understand your question.
Well, the submitters are saying the operative plan is what we should be doing, so that the benefits and costs, they say, are the change from the operative plan. Section 32AA asks us to consider benefits and costs and changes for the rules from what was notified,
yes,
rather than what the operative plan says.
Yes.
Does there any requirement for us to consider in section 32AA what the operative plan says?
Well, the panel's, your recommendations and the council's decision has to, so section 32AA on any differences between notification and your recommendation. So that 32AA needs, so the position that's landed on needs to be justified in terms of it being more appropriate than what was notified. And so the council has provided section 32AA type analysis with its section 42A in order to assist the panel and say, well, this is, here's our section 32AA and it's provided to help you, and it supports the position that was moved to from notification. And in the first hearing, some submissions were made as to submitters not needing to provide any assistance to the panel in terms of section 32 type AA type analysis, whether that be technical support, cost benefits, and I think it was just planning evidence filed in support of that position. But our closing pushback on that, we don't accept that position. The panel's recommendation needs to be supported, and the comparison is what's been notified. So to go back to the ODP, well, if that's where we move to, then this is the comparison that's needed.
Right, but equally, I can understand the argument. If we weren't minded to move from the notified plan at all, then that's one position. But I'm concerned that, well, particularly given that Mr. Bryce is recommending some material shifts from the notified position, as soon as you shift, you have to consider alternatives. And clearly one alternative that would need consideration would be the ODP position.
Yes.
So, is it?
Yes. And I believe that section 42A has done that. So he has weighed up essentially anywhere between notified and going back to the operative plan, which is the default control activity status. So his recommendations have weighed up all of those options. As I mentioned earlier, there are a variety of submissions seeking different outcomes in terms of the activity status.
Well, having started that ball before rolling, I'm happy with that as far as it goes. Unless you have some more questions, Mr. Chair.
Okay. So paragraph 5.23, this is about Jack's point. I don't think I need to take you through this given the discussion we had earlier about Jack's point, but just to clarify that the council's position is that control activity status at Jack's point is appropriate if it's in accordance with the structure plan, and there was some refinement to the chapter required to make that clear. Turning to the code of practice and subdivision design guidelines. Both of these documents were incorporated.
Just before you do, I'm just looking at paragraph 5.24, which actually isn't about tax point, I suspect. The deletion of the lot sizes, averages and dimensions. I'm just wondering, when spirit of the council in that situation has considered the situation in subdivisions where lot sizes might be marginally smaller than those set out for minimum lot sizes, and whether doing away with discretion on lot sizes may actually be shooting themselves in the foot, so to speak.
If I may, I might refer that question to Mr. Price.
Okay.
Yes. And in terms, when I get to the part of these submissions responding to the evidence, they really do set out Mr. Price's position.
Yes.
And the questions are probably best directed at him.
Okay.
As well. Thank you. I will get to the other shortly. So, in terms of the code of practice and the subdivision guidelines, both were incorporated by reference into the plan and notification. They were referred to in policies that were notified and submitted to seek the deletion of those apologies, in that they referred to these documents, the code and the subdivision design guidelines. At paragraph 6.3 and 6.4, I just set up the general principles as to refrigeration by reference. But generally, they are external documents like these are used in a plan to provide a basis for a standard so that a subdivision or an activity must comply with the content of that external document. And of course, they have legal effect as if they formed part of the plan. Whether a document is actually incorporated by reference depends on how it's used in the plan and a part of the plan. Clause 30 of Schedule 1 says that a council may incorporate a document by reference, but once it is incorporated by reference, what it means is that that version of the document is essentially frozen and you can only change it by way of a variation or a change.
Ms. Scott, in relation to that principle, which is of course well known, Mr. Ferguson in his evidence suggests that that principle doesn't apply where you use external documents as part of assessment criteria as opposed to a standard, which is the example you've just given. And I wondered if you had any comment on do you agree with that as a point of legal principle, and can you give me some case law that bears upon the point, because I have to say it was news to me.
Yes, so in terms of, clearly that's the standard in a rule which is incorporated by reference and it's a requirement that you comply with it. When you are moving into a matter of discretion, then again, it is still incorporated by reference. I understand that the evidence is talking about assessment criteria, and we haven't used them in that manner in this chapter. And I can't refer you to any case law at this moment, but I can go away and have a look at it. The case law is to incorporation by reference is fairly scarce, and there tends to be a lot of confusion across, a lot of different approaches taken to this through different plans in New Zealand. And
just while you're thinking about that, does reference elsewhere in the chapter outside of the rules, such as the introductory section or the objects and policies, does that find, and if it were not incorporated, would that bind it to the version at the time it was made operative or not?
If it hasn't been incorporated by reference, then no. It's the working through the process in Part 3 of Schedule 1 that incorporates it by reference, and you have to follow that process. But There are ways of referring to external documents in chapters so that they are not incorporated by reference. An example is in Christchurch in the subdivision chapter, where the panel has not incorporated the code by reference, the equivalent code of practice by reference, but has a list of reference materials and guidelines to assist applicants and clarify that the council may elect to refer to these documents when setting subdivision consent conditions. So that means that, for example, if it's the code of practice, as we have here in Queenstown, that may evolve in terms of the code that is currently council's current version. And an issue, by way of an example, that the problem is in the operative plan here, the transport chapter refers and has incorporated by reference the code, and it's referring to a 2001 version, which is well outdated in terms of what should be being applied.
The next question I have then is, from memory, when the council notified the proposed plan, it incorporated by resolution the code of practice amongst another long list of documents as part of it. Is the suggestion that it be de-incorporated? Is that something that would need to be, if we were agreed, the stance recommended by Mr. Bryce, that our recommendation to council should recommend at the same time that that document be removed from the list of incorporated documents?
Yes, that is correct. So it wouldn't be incorporated by reference, and it was the reference from the provision in the chapter would also, by implication, do that.
But we would actually have to specifically make that recommendation, otherwise it would get lost in the...
Yes, that would be sensible and helpful in terms of
Okay. The thought I was going to inject into the discussion was that it seemed to me, and the Christchurch example is absent, that what the Christchurch panel were doing is drawing a distinction between reference to a document in a regulatory context. Certainly rules would qualify, but I think also objectives and policies because of the special role that they play. Whereas, as the Chair said, reference in an introductory discussion, or as the Christchurch panel have appeared to have done, a for your information type explanation would be in a different category here. What upsets the apple cart is the formal resolution that the code has been incorporated, so any reference to it. Is problematic, but if as the Chair suggests we were to recommend that it be de-incorporated, it might still be the subject of acknowledgement that it exists and it's changing in an introductory discussion or an explanation.
Yes.
You have to...
Yes, agreed. So that is the council's position on the code. In terms of the subdivision guidelines, the council's position is that they remain incorporated by reference, and Mr. Bryce has recommended a specific reference to them as a matter of discretion, which I have listed at the end of paragraph 6.5. So turning now to section 7, this briefly responds to the Upper Clutha Environmental Society's submission, and the submission is a similar vein to what you have heard in strategic directions and actually in rural and spirited as well. And the response there is simply that they've referred to the Glentown Group and Glentown Lakes District Council decision as an example of one where the effectively making residents control activities within OELs, simply a reference that case law is not accepted as authority for that submission, and that is the purpose of responding to that in that petition. It is a consent case, and the court was dealing with a particular situation that was at hand, and I don't think any or much weight can be placed on that submission, but it's part of society.
Follow-up question for you, Mr. Scott, around the society's submission. I'm going to ask Mr. Howard this question. But are you aware of if the society actually lodged a submission seeking non-complying activity status for rural subdivisions, or indeed whether anyone did?
Yeah.
It's the same question I was going to ask, but in a slightly different way. Mr. Howard's written submissions that have been lodged claims that the society did make that submission, in that they made it in the consultative process. Mm. And I would really like to have the council's position on what it thinks that the society's submission extends to.
Yes, their submission also, the relief sought is that the section 32 is redrafted, that we re-notify, presumably with a non-compliant activity status. If I may, I would like to reply to that, cover that in the reply. I have looked at that part of the submission that talks about rewriting the section 32, but I believe it's now Mr. Barr advised me that there may be more than one submission on plan, so I do.
Yes, there are like 20,
yeah.
I think.
Yes, so I just want to be confident that I've looked at all of them to make sure that there's not in there somewhere. But there is an issue because the relief, a submission made on a draft plan that was for consultation purposes prior to notification is not a submission as a matter of law on the plan, and it doesn't provide you with that scope.
Yes, I think it would be worthwhile, you know, because I looked and I couldn't find one.
Yes, yes, but I did have this in my draft submission, and Mr. Barr told me about the other steps, so I pulled it out because I wanted to be confident in what I was advising you on. Okay, so from section 8 onwards, this sets out the consideration and the response to the evidence that has been filed by each of the planners that have provided evidence. I'm happy to take you through this, but I do wonder whether it is just taken as read, and Mr. Bryce may wish to briefly cover each of these, because I don't want to duplicate what he is going to respond.
I've got quite detailed questions on, and I'd like to ask, I think it's simpler to ask Mr. Bryce, because he seems to agrees with him that he's deleted.
Yes.
I'm not quite clear
okay.
What we're actually dealing with. It's easy, I think, if we deal with Mr. Bryce on that.
Yes, well, that would be my question. Which takes me to the end of the written submission. The council's witnesses are Mr. Garth Sartner, here is Mr. Diner.
There's one matter in here which I think is a legal matter. In paragraph 11.2, talking about the issue of the fire service has raised with us, raising with us for the third time in the submission motion. And I see that the council is taking the same position as they've taken in the past. I'm just wondering whether that humble stop would help. I'm just wondering why the council has a problem with referring to this standard or code, but in the noise section it refers to the New Zealand standards for measuring noise, for instance, and whether there's a reason why a fire service code can't be referred to in the same way as a reason, as an option to achieve the outcome that the plan seeks to achieve.
Yes, well, that is an option in terms of the outcome. The council's evidence that has been filed in the Birmingham hearing is that the code that's referred to by the fire service does contain an element of discretion in it, and that it doesn't always set specific standards in terms of what you need to achieve to tick that box, essentially. That is one of the concerns that the council has raised in evidence in earlier hearings.
The same problem arises with measuring noise. That's why we have noise experts to come along and argue about it.
Well, noise is, that is the standard certainly applied, throughout New Zealand and in our New Zealand standards, whereas where they understand that these are I appreciate that these are standards that if there is sufficient confidence that they don't contain any undue discretion, then they can become a standard. But that is the council's evidence that they have that concern. And a different approach has been taken. Well, we haven't got to the noise chapter yet, but as drafted, that is, as notified, that's the council's.
Yes, and certainly your evidence has been on that line, but that's why I just wanted to draw those parallels and say that it might be something, and you can address and apply as to which parts of the discretion are discretionary, which are problematic. Because at the moment, I think there is council's approach of relying on a memorandum of understanding is equally problematic, because that memorandum of understanding could cease at any moment.
Yeah, no, I'm happy to respond to that and reply, and I'm sure Mr. McLeod will be happy to not keep raising this in every hearing.
Another element, your response there, quoting Mr. Barr's response, is that discretion is inappropriate in the context of a permitted activity. And of course, in the subdivision chapter, well, I'm not aware there are any permitted activities. So does the same logic that, well, it might have applied in the context of chapter 21, but does it apply, does the same logic apply here?
We have one permitted activity.
you must tell me what it is.
An adjustment to existing crossways for unit title. Due to an alteration to the size of the lot by alteration to the building outline. Yeah,
right.
First one on the table, but I do take your point that this is this references to Mr. Barr's evidence raises a concern about permitted activity status. I will speak with Mr. Barr about this again, and Mr. Bryce, and we will consider it again in light of your comments.
Thank you. And before you go on to introduce your witnesses, I have one last comment about, last query about scope, where Mr. Bryce volunteered that you would deal with something, and I don't think that you have done, so I want to ask you about it. This is Mr. Bryce's paragraph 13.4, when he's dealing with his explanation as to why he's recommending that some things, some standards go out because they are standards in zones that are not subject of the stage, and I was left a bit puzzled because if the plan provides the standard, isn't it necessarily within scope? Because the plan itself defines scope. I just didn't understand the logic, and you haven't dealt with it. So can you explain to me how this works?
Yes, I can. This is what we briefly touched on at the very start. On p- page 15 of the revised chapter, the 29 June version, sorry, the 19 July version. So in the notified version of this chapter, it states that the subdivision chapter shall not apply to the following zones. And it lists there the zones that have been that haven't been included in the in stage one of the review, so the likes of the industrial zone, for example, flats, free parks, open space zone, and Remarkables Park zone. And those words in the chapter mean that if you read them, the subdivision chapter as a whole doesn't apply to those zones, including the specific provisions that have been included, which is limited to a minimum allotment price. So there are, I accept, there's been notified, there's minimum allotment funds that have been notified for some stage 2 zones, but there's also this clear qualifier which says that the subdivision chapter doesn't apply to those zones. So Mr. Bryce has recommended that they be removed. You may recall back in the strategic direction here, and this was a, one of the queries that was raised by the panel, and there are other options which may have that could or, you know, may have been followed, which were that the provisions were withdrawn from the chapter. But given the wording in the subdivision which states that the chapter doesn't apply to them, then the most straightforward response seems to be to withdraw them, and they will need to be notified in stage 2 alongside the zone chapters.
Except that there's contradiction, which I think is the point that we drew to your attention earlier.
Mm-hmm.
Are you in a position to advise us as to whether in each case there is a submission that would support their withdrawal? There's clearly a submission that some of them be withdrawn, like
Remarkables
Park being ever vigilant on that score.
I'm not in a position to advise you, but Mr. Bryce may be, and if not, we can come back to you on that.
Can you check that, please, because I suppose it's fair to say I'm troubled, because effectively there is an internal contradiction and you're asking us to pick one or which applies.
And and I think we did alert the council very early that it was within the council's power to actually withdraw those parts directly and save us that problem.
Yes.
And they hadn't done that.
Yes, that is correct.
So I think it's important that we have identified the extent that the submissions deal with it.
Okay.
So it's something that's dealt with. Council intends to be dealt with through the submissions, so I think that is what you are submitting. Then if we have that shown to us how it can be, rather than just saying preferred or whatever.
We will come back to you on that.
Thank you.
Thank you, Ralph. Should we turn to Mr. Falter?
Yes. To note that attached to this evidence is the urban design critique of subdivisions in Queenstown, in the Lakes, Queenstown Lakes District. But the version that was attached to our evidence did not include the critique of the two subdivisions that were considered in Wanaka. And so you don't have, at least that table we provided, We don't have that information. And it's certainly referred to by submitter's evidence.
Thank you, my father, Mr. Chairman, that it is, but that there are two separate.
Is it?
My copy's got it.
Yes, that attachment was filed by way of two PDFs. I understand the purpose of filing. So I hope that's not an issue with you not being part of the relevant.
I don't know, I've got the second PDF. That's probably the problem, then.
Yes, would you like a copy here?
Or just the one of the ones. Let me find that.
Engaged by Queenstown Lakes District Council to provide urban design evidence on the subdivision chapter. It's chapter 27 of the proposed district plan. Now, the need for high quality, sustainable living environments as the basis of all subdivisions is now well recognised and perhaps no more so than in this area of Queenstown District, which is under intense pressure with the growing population, but within a region of highly valued landscapes. The benefits of applying best practice urban design to subdivision development are wide ranging, from lowering physical costs, improving human health and well-being, to mitigating the impact of urbanisation on the natural environment. I understand that both the subdivision code of practice and the subdivision design guideline are mutually supportive of good urban design. The code of practice provides substantial information on the requirements of design detail and infrastructure, which are a necessary part of subdivision design. The code of practice is the focus of Mr. Wallace's evidence. Myself, I've been reviewing the existing subdivision design guideline, including comparing them with others nationally and internationally. I have found it to be a clear and concise document. The design guidelines provide helpful assistance for the layout and structure of subdivisions that fit within the local landscape, have well-connected movement networks, integrated reserves and vegetated spaces, lots of design with good spatial definition and orientation to the sun. However, I do note that there is room for improvement, further consideration of context, lot design and built form. I believe the proposed recommendations made by Mr. Bryce generally make subdivision restricted discretionary activity will provide for such required improvements and give greater surety of quality outcomes. I also note that subdivision applications that are supported by a structure plan, which includes integrated design elements, can be a controlled activity. I've made a specific note regarding the need for cross leasing of lots that have greater control, and have recommended these to be a discretionary activity. As a final note, I would support regular monitoring of consented subdivisions, their built form and performance. Applying continuing learnings in such an exercise would be beneficial to the ongoing improvements to the planning and development of subdivisions in the Queenstown District. Finally, I've reviewed statements of submitted evidence filed where they raise issues of relevance to urban design. I note no urban design evidence has been filed by the submitters. Have you any questions?
Thank you, Mr. Faulkner. First thing I want to ask you about is really a philosophical question. You've told us about the origins of good design, good subdivision design, and in the garden movement, and that is, I think that's what you called it. I have got that quite right. The question I have for you is, and you've drawn as I paraphrase you, you've drawn attention to, we've moved from a phase where subdivision was the province of engineers and surveyors to one where it's the province, not just though those disciplines remain very relevant, but it's also the province of urban designers to create quality living environments, and that in the garden movement is part of that process. The question for you is that there is a drive in this district towards greater intensification of existing urban areas. To what extent is that a U-turn in thinking, and are the two mutually contradictory? Do they work together? To what extent do they not work together? I invite you to give me some commentary, because the plan at the moment, Chapter 27, currently suggests that there is a tension between the two.
Gosh, how long have you got this afternoon? I'm sure the commissioners are well aware of the origins of town planning in New Zealand and that. But in the next couple of days we're going to be hearing a lot about from the release of the unitary plan in Auckland, which is about intensifying developments. I think the introduction of the garden city town planning principles in the early 20th century were about providing space and light and air, which addressed the issues at that time, which were the prevalence of overcrowding and poor sanitation and that. And I think the word slum was used a lot at the time, but it also was picked up, and it was conducive to growing mobility and the outward expansion of segregated residential environments that were segregated from industry and commerce, fed first by trams and then by the uptake of the motor vehicle. I think you raised a very good point here in that we're now dealing with a purposeful defined growth boundary to the settlements around the Queenstown district. There's finite land in those areas, and we are looking at gaining a greater efficiency. And I think the basis of a lot of urban design thinking and discussion in the last 10-15 years has been about that addressing that fundamental issue. That our town planning statutes to be based on expansion and freedom and space, and it's led to a situation where we make our living environment sustainable going into the future, and post fossil fuel future potentially, but we're going to actually have to restrict some of those aspects, have greater control. And I guess where the pendulum sort of lies at the moment, we're moving gradually towards that, and we're seeing smaller lots, greater facilities, better consideration on the need to deal with integrated design when you're living in a smaller environment. And I think there's some there's some good examples of medium density in, locally. I was just in Lake Hayes Estates a couple of weeks ago, having on this afternoon lunch at the Soul Cafe there, and next to that is a medium density development and lots of about 150 square metres, homes of 2 to 3 levels. And that's, I think it's quite a good example and it's in contrast to a lot of the larger lots around the area. So to answer your question, on a philosophy, I guess we are after well, perhaps both carrot and stick. I think what we're seeing in Wanaka, and we're seeing a lot of developments in Wanaka in low density based developments. We're seeing developers provide a lot of good design, a lot of facilities, thinking of open space and communal facilities, a lot of consideration to the detail, the road layout and the planting and all that. And that's partly driven by controls, but also partly driven by public perception of what is a quality environment. I hope I've
used the lunch. Accepting that, well, no doubt you could talk for the rest of the day on the subject, and there will be a tome written that we will be able to read about shortly from your Auckland panel. My next question relates to the BOFA's critique of various subdivisions around the place. And it seemed to me that, and this is a point that some of the submitted evidence focuses on, a lot of the areas where the BOFA's team found some of the subdivisions to fall down relative to design criteria relate more to what I would call urban design than to subdivision design. Things like the fact that the houses are not big enough, the fences are too high, so that creates an undesirable environment. And so the question for you, which I'm afraid is another open-ended, deeply philosophical question, Where does subdivision controls stop and urban design controls start? Like, I suspect it's not a line at all, but at what point moves outside the purview of the subdivision process and into land use controls? Now, that may be a legal question, maybe a planning question, but I thought I'd start with you.
Okay. And by the way, I published a book last year, it's 512 pages long, it took me 8 years to research, and if you'd like to refer to that, there's a lot of background to some of these questions you're traversing in that book, so I encourage you to have a look at it. The BOFA critique was an urban design critique. It was based on a number of, I think, 9 criteria, and about half of those were, you could define as being more qualitative, looking at items like enclosure and character, legibility. Now, I think throughout the country we're seeing a shift towards urban design, which is integrated by nature, so it's integrated of different disciplines and their perspectives and technical backgrounds, but also integrated with quantitative and qualitative aspects to planning and development of subdivisions. And I mentioned timber Auckland unitary plan before that. That is fundamentally based on urban design principles. So I think we are seeing that as a trend. I think probably answers your question before. This is we're resolving some of these inherent contradictions in some of our planning, I guess. Does that answer your question?
Well, I think I'll return to the frame of Mr. Bryce. He would probably get the drift of where I'm coming from. The next question is, in terms of the Boffa's critique, you've obviously reviewed it, you've produced it, you said that you've been around and you've looked at the place. Do you agree with the conclusions that they came to?
Yes, fundamentally, I thought it was a well-researched, well-carried-out critique with a good methodology. The conclusions were that, dealing with a number of reasonably old subdivisions, well-established subdivisions that have been done in the last 10, 15 years, a number of them were very very orthodox, very regular. That's a number of good fundamentals in the design. And there's some variability, but I guess the concerning thing for me in my my review of my primary evidence was the lack of any of the subdivisions to achieve a very good or excellent rating. It was very kind of mediocre, very middle of the road, and in some areas less than satisfactory, I think, was the terminology that the assessment was made in. I think really what we were after is promoting excellence in that subdivision.
You'll forgive me if I do the lawyer's thing and suggest that you didn't answer the question, which is, do you agree with the conclusions that they drew?
Sorry, I thought that I began my...
I may have missed that.
Yeah, I do.
Thank you.
And my primary evidence, I state that.
And the... Just going to your evidence, just for a point of clarification, just looking at your executive summary in paragraph 3, 2.1A. This may be just I think this is just a language issue. There is intense pressure on providing quality subdivision. I think that what you mean is that there is intense pressure to provide sub-quality subdivision design. Am I correct in inferring that, or is it correct as you put it?
The full sentence reads, due to the huge growth in population in the area...
That's why I inferred that.
Yeah. So there is intense pressure on providing quality subdivision design. I think, 20 years ago, elders could have got away with subdivisions of lesser quality than if you get away with.
So I was wrong, and it is right. The pressure is on providing quality subdivision to be, in effect, competitive in the market.
And to our standards, our planning and design and development standards, which should be on the same page.
Now, at the very bottom of that page, your conclusion is that all large subdivisions seeking consent should be reviewed by the Urban Design Panel. And my question is that in Chapter 27 currently, and if it's not, should it be?
My colleagues will know more about this than me. I understand at the moment there have been a number of subdivisions that have been reviewed by the Urban Design Panel, and that's at the discretion of the planning office. So I think that's occurred in larger subdivisions, ones that are perhaps more complex. I've been on the Auckland Design Panel since Foundation, and that, and I've said, recently joined the urban design panel down here, and we've just last week reviewed a residential development next to the 3 Mile Island, commercial development, 3 Mile Island was the nuclear.
Cybersoft Revival.
Commissioner, if I may, it's not a requirement in the chapter as drafted.
Well, I suppose I'll reiterate my question then for your witness. Do you think it should be?
That was my recommendation, yes. On larger.
And lastly, paragraph 6.5, you cross-refer the hypothetical subdivision case Skerr Heights, which is set out in the subdivision guidelines. And one planning witnesses, emphasised planning witnesses, suggests that that's in fact an example of poor urban design. And given that he is demonstrably not qualified in the field, and you are, I thought I'd give you the opportunity to comment. Were you happy with that example as an example of that should be followed as a matter of good design?
Yeah, interesting point. In the subdivision design guidelines, it's not actually noted what that particular element is. As a recently domiciled Wanaka resident, I did recognise it, and I threw my colleagues' attention to that fact. Maybe that was... the relevance of it was that council owned land until recently, and it's an example of reasonably orthodox low density development. The area that had been developed around it, and which often is the context of a number of our subdivisions seeking consent. So I think by selecting an area that wasn't totally greenfields, wasn't medium density, but was low density, we were dealing with something that was was common, was to be expected, and the following the layers of applying the urban design principles to it, which culminated in the final sheet that I had for me here, it was a good. This page here. There was a reason we're not going to school. Probably a good example to choose them. That was from the last page of my finishes, the subdivision design. I think it's got a page number on it actually. Figure 4.
That's fine. I don't think we need take you chapter and verse through the critique. If you're happy with it, that's good enough for me. Thank you very much, Mr. Booker.
Just following on from that, Mr. Faulkner, I was wondering if you had seen the evidence which critiqued that subdivision guideline, and it was Mr. Wells' evidence. Have you seen that?
No.
I'm just wondering, it might be helpful for us if you could have a look at that at the adjournment, because we're going to adjourn in about 3 minutes. And then I'd just like to check going through, because Mr. Wells has gone through various aspects of the guidelines and said, well, the example doesn't do this and the example doesn't do that. And I'd like it to be useful if you could actually look at that and then comment. Yes. So, I think in that case we'll take the afternoon adjournment now, and Mr. Faulkner can look at that, and we will return at 3:30. week.
Thank you.